Dalton, thank you very much indeed, and welcome to this Global Strategy Forum. I see many faces I know, and you will all know that I have views on this subject. I am today the neutral chair and will have no views on the subject. I may have to revise that on Saturday when we debate it at the Lib Dem conference. Our panellists, drawn from both the Labour and Conservative parties, also have variable views, and the Times, when it did its poll on what the nation thinks, came up with 52%, I think, of the population wanting to keep in the nuclear business. And that was reflected by divisions slightly varying between the three parties. But this is an issue which affects all the political parties and the population, and there are very different views. So the more we can do to inform ourselves, the better, and I know that we will have a very good starting point from our speakers, all of whom have had ministerial appointments and important various relevant jobs in terms of opposition as well. But I'm going to start by asking Malcolm Rifkin to speak, and then I'll go to Frank, and then to Michael Ankle. Malcolm.
Thank you very much indeed, Tim. My role this morning is a slightly unusual one. I am the representative of Her Majesty's government. I shall be putting forward the New Labour Blairite policy and perhaps be opposed by that well-known Benite, Michael Ancram. He may be supporting Tony Benn. I prefer to support Hillary Benn on this particular occasion. And Frank, I'm sure, will also make an exceptional and very personal contribution, as is his wont. Now, starting point. First of all, I welcome the debate, and that's another matter I share with some critics of the government. There needs to be a very wide debate. It is a hugely important issue, and it would be a ghastly mistake simply to assume that the policy pursued over the last 30, 40 years automatically has to continue. That's the first point. Second point linked to that, I accept that those of us, like myself, who argue for a continuation of Britain's independent nuclear deterrent, the onus is on us, not on those who criticise that position. It may be the status quo, but nevertheless, such is the importance of this issue, such are the wider implications, that the onus must be on those who want to maintain a British deterrent to argue why it is desirable, not simply to refute the other arguments. And the third consideration, I make this simply in terms of my own background. I had the responsibility between 1992 and 1995, when I was Defence Secretary, of having responsibility on a day-to-day basis for the Trident nuclear deterrent, and I discovered in 1995, when I became Foreign Secretary, a more ominous responsibility. Under our system, it is the Prime Minister who personally would take the decision, if that decision was ever needed, as to whether to use our deterrent. But of course, there may be circumstances in which the Prime Minister was dead or incapacitated, and others have to be therefore nominated by him in advance. And Michael Heseltine, as Deputy Prime Minister, was the number two guy, and I discovered that I had become the number three guy, which is a pretty disturbing thought, if ever these circumstances have arisen. So that's the background. Now, the first point I want to address is this an independent nuclear deterrent anyway? Because again and again I've heard this argument, I think it's a nonsensical argument, that the British deterrent isn't independent because we acquire the missiles from the United States and have other arrangements with the United States. The reality is quite simple to establish. The question is, if we ever wish to use the deterrent, do we need anyone else's permission? Is there either any legal or technical requirement that would be dependent on the Americans giving their approval? And the answer is no, there is not. If a British Prime Minister decided the deterrent was to be used, that is a decision that can be taken and implemented entirely as a result of British decision-making. The fact that we acquire the missiles from the United States is no different than any government around the world that purchases many of its armaments from other countries. That does not make the use of these armaments dependent on prior approval from elsewhere. I make that point because, although it's obvious in my view, it nevertheless is a consideration that is often raised. Secondly, on the question of cost, of course none of us can be absolutely certain what the cost will be, but we do have the evidence of the last 20, 30 years. The government's estimate, and based on the current cost, is that the ongoing cost of running the deterrent would be something around about 5 to 6% of our defence budget. That is not only a very modest element, 94% would be used on other aspects of defence, but it also compares very favourably with France, which spends somewhere between 10 and 20% of its defence budget because it is required, because of its own policy decisions, to generate the full deterrent from its own sources. It doesn't acquire it from elsewhere. Now, let me turn to the main arguments as to whether it's desirable or sensible to have a deterrent, particularly in the circumstances that now exist since the end of the Cold War in 1989-1990. And there are three arguments that I would like to share with you. And for me, they are very persuasive. Each of you will have to make up your own mind. The first is that, of course, the original purpose of the deterrent was because of the Cold War and the fact that the Soviet Union, which was an ideological enemy and possibly an enemy in other respects, was itself a nuclear superpower. And the United Kingdom, together with the United States and France, felt the need, most people accepted this as right and proper, that we should have this opportunity to have the ultimate defence potential. The arguments that people make is, well, the Cold War is behind us, the Soviet Union no longer exists, there is no comparable nuclear power, why do we therefore need to retain the deterrent? My first response is, yes, that is true, that is absolutely true, but we are talking about a system of defence that has a life of some 30 years, sometimes 30, 40 years, depending on circumstances. Not one of us is able to contemplate what will happen in Russia, in the territory that was the Soviet Union, over that period of time. We've seen just how in the last 10, 15 years, some of the high hopes that we had for Russia becoming a normal Western-style open parliamentary democracy have virtually disappeared. Not because Russia has gone back to being a Soviet-style dictatorship, it hasn't, it's a far better country today than it was in the past. But not only have we seen a drift back towards authoritarianism, but we have also are conscious of the fact that none of us know who's going to be ruling Russia over the next 20 or 30 years. At one stage, a chap called Zhirinovsky, who you'll be pleased to know, Mr. Chairman, described himself as a liberal democrat, but was the most extreme Russian nationalist that the system has produced. He might have defeated Yeltsin. He was thought to be a strong runner at one stage. God forbid what might have happened if he had ever been in control of Russia. Russia remains a nuclear superpower. It has every intention of remaining a nuclear superpower. And therefore, although I have no reason to believe that Russia will be a threat in at that sense to the United Kingdom, nor can I give, or anybody else give, a guarantee that it would. The second consideration is that, of course, there have been a growth of other nuclear powers over the last few years. Not just India, Pakistan and Israel, but also, more disturbingly, North Korea, Iran, and no doubt others may be in the pipeline. And these are countries which not only might have or are likely to have nuclear weapons, but they also pose a very potential threat to Western interests. Only this weekend, it was reported that Iran had launched a rocket 94 miles into the atmosphere, and the Iranians themselves imply that they are wanting to develop a potential ballistic missile technology. They haven't said it explicitly, but that's consistent with the kind of tests that are going on at the moment. Clearly, it would be foolish in that circumstance for us to be the one country that goes in the opposite direction. Thirdly, with regard to terrorist organizations, they sometimes say, well, what use would a nuclear weapon be with regard to terrorist organizations? You can't form a terrorist organization in that way. Of course that is true. But I make two points, and they're very important points. First of all, there's the psychological dimension. Terrorist organizations would see it as an enormous and almost incomprehensible sign of weakness on the part of the Western countries. If countries like Britain were to unilaterally remove their nuclear weapons, they would see that as a lessening of our will to and our resolve to defend ourselves. But also, many of these terrorist organizations have sponsored governments, like Iran and others, who would indeed be deterred. The final point I make, Chairman, because I know my time is running out, is that having nuclear weapons doesn't mean you have them only at one level. Britain, almost more than any of the other existing nuclear powers, has dramatically reduced the level of nuclear weaponry that it has over the last 20 or 30 years. We no longer have tactical nuclear weapons. We no longer have freefall nuclear weapons. We no longer have any proposals for ground-launch nuclear weapons, and we have reduced the number of warheads carried by the Trident system far, far more than anyone ever believed possible. That happened under successive governments. So my conclusion, Chairman, is that you can have the gradual process of reducing the military potential in the light of the international circumstance. But ultimately, nuclear weapons are a great insurance policy for this country. We are a responsible country, and just as you don't get rid of the insurance policy because your house hasn't burned down yet, so it would be foolish to apply a different principle with regard to this means of deterrence. Thank you.
Thank you for your time, Keating, and over to Frank Hill.
Thank you. When the government published its paper, it said it was the initiation of a debate. It's quite clear the government's definition of debate is different from most others of us, in that it does publish various views, then expects them to be endorsed. And I genuinely think that we should be having a debate, but the first of the 2 points that I want to make is that the debate should be much wider than Trident. We do need to take into account the circumstances of the Iraq war. In the weeks immediately following Suez, when Eden thought he would remain as Prime Minister, he wrote a Prime Ministerial note on what he thought the longer term strategic, diplomatic and economic consequences of the Suez disaster were. It's a very short note. It may well be the Prime Minister's state of mind is such that he's not able yet to undertake such an activity. But that activity does need to be undertaken. We went into a war with our closest ally, and it would appear that we were unwilling or unable to try and influence the policy from day two onwards. And to pretend that we're in a world prior to that, when we're discussing defence and security arrangements, is to be naive to the extreme. I can understand why senior politicians might want to pretend these events have not occurred, because they're very painful ones to register and to respond to. And Barbara Wilson wrote in her autobiography that when her husband died in the First World War, they'd been married on a Thursday evening, she saw him off in Victoria Station on a Sunday morning, and 6 weeks later the telegram arrived, "We regret to inform you." The corner of the telegram was torn. But of course the events, the significance of the telegram was such that the whole of her and her mother's effort went on how outrageous it was to receive a telegram with the corner torn, rather than having to, because they couldn't grapple with the terrible news in the telegram. And I think we're in the Wootton syndrome at the moment. So at some stage, the government does need to rethink what our strategic position is post-Iraq. That is not to say it's going to come up with different answers, but not to undertake that review is a negation of duty. To undertake the review doesn't necessarily mean that one would come up with the right answer. Because if you read the Eden memo, his conclusion on one front was that we must never ever do anything unless we have American approval. And that itself, if that is a policy which is continued to be followed, it does raise questions which I'm sure Malcolm is going to answer in question time. But if the policy is always to follow a policy that America approves of, what is the point actually of having the independent deterrent? So that's the first point. One is that we don't just need a debate about Trident, we urgently need that, but it needs to be a debate on a much wider front than the government is at the moment proposing. Secondly, I do think as somebody who defends nuclear weapons and continues to do so, that we need to take into account much more actively how the argument has changed from dealing with, say, the Russians. Well, whatever one thought about the Russians, I was always assured by those very clever people who knew so much more than I on this and most other subjects than myself, that one was dealing essentially with a rational system. that not only was there a leadership, but there was below the leadership an organisation which was ready to respond to the unexpected so that one didn't trip into nuclear war. And here again I use a historical analogy. In the last year before the last war, Chamberlain wrote to one of his sisters, and as always in those letters to his two sisters, incredibly honest, said to her that, "You do realise, of course, I'm dealing with a maniac. And how do you, if you're a rational human being, respond adequately to a maniac?" And I think we've moved from a world which was horrendous but more rational to one where we're dealing with powers which certainly try to convince us that they're irrational. If we think about Iran. And therefore the old argument that the balance of terror, it will deter because people realise what you will do to them, doesn't necessarily hold the weight that it did. And the debate has moved on in a second sense since the last big debate we had about nuclear weapons in this country. And that was we're seeing the spread of nuclear weapons into many more nations. And while it's important to debate our own strategic and defence commitments and requirements, much more effort ought to be given into how and on what terms might one prevent the spread of nuclear weapons to yet more countries. On the very simple but obvious point that the more countries which have them officially, let alone unofficially, the greater the chance that there must be at some stage that they will be used. And that might bring in other nuclear powers as well. And therefore I underscore the point that when we are rethinking Triton, we ought to be rethinking, is there any role that we can play in seeing that our own position and our own decisions might either enhance the numbers of countries that want nuclear weapons, or by our own decision lessen the number. My last point is the obvious point, and that is that there are stages that we have to undergo in making the Trident commitment. The government tries to present that there's a single decision to be made, and there are clearly at least two stages. There is a decision which we ought to make sure that all we are approving, if that's what we approve of, when we come back to this debate in the Commons in a month or so. And that is, as Malcolm has put, it is sensible at this stage to be undertaking the work which, at a second stage, if we wish to replace the Trident vote, we could actually do so. The costs at this stage are minimal compared with entering that second gateway. And given how quickly the world has changed in the last 10 years, it seems to me that we would be acting irrationally if we made a decision now which prevented a government in 10 years' time saying we actually now want to go the full hog and do a replacement of the vote. So the comments that I try to put before you, I don't think we should be having this debate, though necessarily we're having it today, on a narrow canvas. We ought to be drawing that canvas much more broadly, which takes into account what the consequences for this country longer term are of the disasters of the Iraq war and our very close association with America. Secondly, while I fully support undertaking some of the technical work at this stage for the replacement of Trident, I do think those of us who may at the end of the day be arguing for that full programme, we do need to take our arguments up gear from what they were last time. That the emphasis on irrational powers in the world and those possessing nuclear weapons are much greater. And secondly, I don't think we should just simply ignore the spread of nuclear weapons as though that's an inevitable outcome. But a good sitting next to a Liberal Democrat, I'm very happy sitting on the fence on this issue.
Thank you for that, Frank. It's always good to sit next to a Liberal Democrat. We'll have Michael to give the final view.
I think one thing we're all agreed on is the need for debate. In fact, I think the debate should actually go wider than just in this country. And I was very interested to see that people like Henry Kissinger and other senior Americans are calling for an international debate into the whole role of nuclear weapons in the future. And that's something that I would very strongly welcome. It's a strange debate at the moment because, in a sense, we all want to say, do we think we should have Trident today or not have Trident today? But that's not the issue. What we're talking about is whether we want to have a replacement for Trident in 15 years' time. But it isn't about whether we should have nuclear arms now. We're going to have them for the next 15 years anyway. So what we're really looking at is what comes after that. My view, and I was a strong supporter of nuclear weapons during the Cold War, made many speeches on this, is that the Cold War was an ideal arena for nuclear weapons as a deterrent. There was a nuclear doctrine, we knew who our enemy was, we knew what the extent of the threat was, and we were able to match it. It created that situation which became euphemistically known as mutually assured destruction now, on the basis that that meant that those weapons were never used. And that is essentially the perfect way of having a deterrent. But the world has changed, and I think we have to look at this whole issue again with new and fresh eyes. I believe in deterrent, but I think deterrent has to meet three basic criteria. First of all, it has to be proportionate to the threat. Secondly, it has to be credible. And to be credible, it has to be effective. So first of all, I ask the question, do we need a nuclear deterrent? Is it going to be in 15 years' time proportionate to the threat? A nuclear weapon is a weapon of mass destruction. It's devastating, it creates enormous contamination. Its deterrent value lies in the threat of it, rather than the use of it. If it's used, then it's failed in its purpose of being a deterrent. And in order to make sure it works, we have to, as we did in the Cold War, be able to draw very clearly the lines beyond which a tripwire would be tripped and the weapon would be used. And that was where the credibility was based. Times have now radically changed, and I suspect they will change even more. I can't see any more than I'll come into the future 15 years. But the way the world is going is that the enemy is becoming less easy to identify, and the threat is becoming less easy to assess. And therefore, to have a credible deterrent of the sort we had in the Cold War is, I think, a wrong decision. The justification which is sometimes made for what Nelson referred to as the independent deterrent is that it gives us a cut, an influence, and certainly the French have always thought that. I'm very nervous of that argument, because if I was sitting in Tehran or in some of these other countries and I saw that the way you got influence in the world was to have nuclear weapons, then that is an encouragement for proliferation rather than an argument against proliferation, so I find that argument a difficult one. So what we're really looking at here is the question of the credibility of the deterrent. The sort of enemy we have today, and maybe the sort of enemy we have tomorrow, are going to be those rogue elements, Iran, the North Korea. And what we need to ask ourselves is, do we believe, or do they believe, even more importantly, that in certain circumstances we would fire a nuclear weapon at Tehran? And my view, the answer is that the answer to that is no. The credibility isn't that, and therefore it is not a deterrent. The fact that at the moment Tehran is trying to acquire nuclear weapons is not being deterred by the fact that we have nuclear weapons, and the United States have nuclear weapons. So I do think that credibility question is absolutely essential. And that goes again to the question that Malcolm raised about the independent deterrent. I agree with him that in theory it is independent, but none of us ever believed, at least I didn't, and I never met anybody who did, that we would actually use our nuclear weapon without at least the assent of the Americans. And that is the reality. As long as the credibility isn't that, it isn't a deterrent. Are there alternatives to it? I find this difficult to answer. I have sent some information on something which is called the kinetic energy of hypersonic mass, which in very short, simple terms means the effect of a solid and dense object hitting the Earth at great speed like a meteor. All I know is that there has been work done into this. I can't give you further information on it, but I believe that these are the sort of weapons we should be looking at, which are not contaminating, are much more flexible to use, could be independent, and I think that's work that should be done before we take any final decision on Trident. Do we have to decide now? This is, I think, one of the crucial questions. I went the other day, and I get a read this quotation to you from someone called Professor Darwin, who came with evidence that he has been for some time a senior advisor to the American government on these matters. He said this on the 23rd of January. "We believe the decision to replace the submarines is highly trenched. The US Trident submarines operate 2/3 of the time at sea, and the UK submarines about 1/4 of the time at sea. The lifespan of the US submarines has been extended to 45 years, and by the same token, I would expect the United Kingdom submarine could last 100 years. He then went on rather more aptly to say, "I see no reason why they should not last 45 years from now. And from my experience with defense programs in the US, I think the government is hastening this decision before the facts are readily available to it or Parliament." And what in a sense he was saying is that we don't need to take this decision for another 15 years. Within that period, we can look at all these arguments that have been deployed today. We can have a serious examination by Privy Councillors if necessary, and we can come to a decision based on the facts and not on what I feel is a very propagandist white paper. So I'm arguing don't take the decision now. If we are forced to take the decision now, my answer would be no.
Thank you, Michael, and thank you to each of the three panel members. We'll have just a 5-minute exchange so that they can come back on various points. Perhaps I can start with Malcolm. A couple of questions that really came out, I think both from Frank and Michael, that the question of the credibility in this future that you're talking about, right, an uncertain future, the irrationality of the actors.
Right.
And the other one is whether we need to take a decision now anyway.
Right. Let me respond to the point that Frank and Michael raised. Frank made the point about should we always follow US policy? Certainly not. And Frank and I and others are very critical of US policy on Iraq and believe the British government was wrong to follow it. But it's that's an argument, forgive me, for our independent deterrent. Because the assumption for the last 50 years has been that the United States would always guarantee the security of the United Kingdom if it was faced with an attack by its own nuclear deterrent. Precisely because there at least has to be the possibility that over the next 30 years the United States and Western Europe will drift apart. We cannot necessarily assume that the US would risk its own existence in order to protect us. I'm not saying we wouldn't, we just cannot make that assumption over a time scale of 30 years.
Can I just... But do you think it's credible for us to say that we would use these weapons if the Americans privately, let alone publicly, forbade us to do so?
Let us imagine a scenario where NATO has ceased to be an effective force. Not impossible over a 30-year period. The United States has concentrated on its own priorities, and within the European context, a Russia led by some very wild man threatens, not just Britain, threatens Western Europe, and seeks to, by conventional or other means, to deny us our freedom. For Britain and France, let's assume the French moved in the same direction, to have given up their nuclear weapons, and therefore for Russia to be the only nuclear power in Europe, without the United States umbrella, would expose us to the kind of blackmail that we have always been determined to avoid. I'm not saying that's going to happen, I'm saying it's a scenario that is not fantastic.
The second point, before you get your second point, do you buy that?
No.
I think more importantly, it's a question of credibility. Does anybody else buy it? Do the people we are trying to defer really believe that the United Kingdom on its own, in those circumstances, would use a nuclear weapon against a rearmed Russia? And my view is that that is actually, in terms of the psychology of it, incredible. Okay. It's incredible. It isn't.
No, forgive me. If you have a nuclear monopoly in Europe, in the kind of circumstances I've described, and Russia has that nuclear monopoly, and it's led by a very irresponsible government. If it knows that we have only conventional forces to protect ourselves, then we have to surrender. There is no alternative policy faced with such a threat if the United States will not protect us. If we have nuclear weapons, then the threat that the Russian government in these circumstances might make could be deterred, because Russia is ultimately a rational government likely to take that into account. So these are extreme circumstances, but who would have said 10 years ago that the Twin Towers in New York were going to be attacked successfully by an unknown terrorist organization?
Yes. Second point.
Now, the second point, and it's not that different from what we've just been discussing. Michael said in the case of Iran that we would have no rational means of deterring them because we would not be expected to actually use our nuclear weapons. Go back to the First Gulf War. When the United States said to Iraq, you, the Iraqis, warned Saddam Hussein at the beginning of the Gulf War, we know you use chemical weapons against your own people and against the Iranians. If you use chemical weapons in this conflict, and if you use them against either Israel or against the coalition, you will be attacked in a comparable way. That was the private message they got. Now, whether that meant chemical or biological or nuclear, in a sense, is incidental. Saddam Hussein, although he had chemical weapons at that time, did not use them even when he faced defeat, because the deterrent factor worked. Now, in the case of Iran, Iran is a rational government. There are some irrational people around, some of the terrorists are irrational, but some of the main rogue states are quite irrational. North Koreans are perfectly rational. The Iranians are perfectly rational. Neither wish themselves to be destroyed or have their whole infrastructure taken out. So it is not unreasonable to assume that if we have that capacity, that will influence their action.
I think it's getting up to that. I think it's a very dangerous argument. That I was in Jerusalem 10 days ago, where the strong argument was we must at all costs stop Tehran getting nuclear weapons. If your argument is right, a nuclear armed Israel and a nuclear armed Tehran, both sensible, both understanding the way the world works, would be a much more stable situation than just one of them. If you're not careful, you encourage people to deplete nuclear weapons precisely to achieve the sort of stability you're talking about. I think that's very dangerous.
Listening to the debate, and you want the time to debate, where do you see yourself placed on these two edges of the Conservative Party?
I just again go back with a historical analogy that America, quite properly, as a superpower, wields its influence in different ways. If you go back to Suez, they began to and would have destroyed our currency. So I do not believe we're, as currently constituted, very free agents. And that's why I said that we needed the sort of review that Eden himself was prepared to contemplate, although he's taken us down the road that we are now down. I found it strange, I should have read it this morning, but it's some time since I read the election address of the Conservatives in the last election. And here's a party which has historically been about empire, about Commonwealth, foreign affairs. There's never mention of Commonwealth in the election manifesto. Now, it's been written out of our consciousness. And if we are having the sort of review I think we should be having, and we begin to learn some very unpleasant lessons from the Iraq War, we obviously are trying to see other ways, other power blocks, which we might begin to have some influence. And I just find it strange that whenever one raises the question that we've dissipated the whole value of Commonwealth, that nobody puts any effort into it at all, a glazed look comes across the audience's eyeballs. It may be that this is an issue which is time past, but part of this review we do need to think, how do we best seek to influence world events? And I think we're writing out one of the organisations which has a lot to teach the world, and of which these particular debates ought to be take place through.
I'm going to open it up to
I think if I'm right in the same manifesto, there wasn't a mention of nuclear.
There wasn't. There wasn't. There were the Lib Dem and the Labour one. They both said the same. I'll take a number of points to the floor and get the panel to come back, because we've got 25 minutes and an awful lot of people. If you could say who you are and where you're from, if you want to say where you're from, in the front.
Hi there, Lee Willis from Ruthie. Can I go around two quick comments and a quick question?
Yes, it's also quick.
Well, first of all, I think if you're looking at it in context of does terrorists work or does not work, while we have had, since 1945, a series of major states versus minor states wars by proxy, you can argue that there has been no major state wars since 1945. So there is an argument that nuclear weapons have had a stabilizing effect in terms of are you talking about having a world in which nuclear weapons are a reality, but state-to-state war is less a reality, or getting rid of that and having increases in major state-to-state war. The second point is regarding the submarine life, and trying to assume to Mr. Rector, look, 45 years for an American boat, on the form of argue as a modern site, is because they are designed and built for that, whereas the British boats are not. You may be able to do that this time around, but with the current hang-up part, you can't do that. So that's the argument there. In terms of the question, though, all three speakers raised the issue of the debate and the importance of having more of it. Now, I, for one, have been to a fair number of these seminars, and there are a fair number coming up in the coming months. So the debate is very active here and in the media, The government has put out a white paper that is 50 pages long compared to what was written in SDR, which is about 8 or 9 pages. Secretary of State has made two major public statements since to the Defence Committee. And the Prime Minister looked at the front and argued that they were the white paper, or the Friday the white paper released, that it was remiss upon the government to present a policy to Parliament and not a green paper that it was supposed to cut off. I'd just like to get the panel's opinion on how it might to see this debate more fully engaged.
Okay. Carry in the back.
I'm not in WFU program. It comes back to the series of Einstein's points about the evidence in the white paper. I have been working with four scientists at university and discovered that I have seen the follow-up comments after the 56th of Spain, Deborah gave a testimony to the Senate a couple of weeks ago. In that, he made a statement to Sussman that four scientists are seriously questioning. I can't hear what the statistics may be on the property of the transvestite, because they question the assumptions about when the life on the government begins. The whole question that they raised of the length of the UK and the FD different, the design of the party. An email that says that the UK and the UK and the approved on it. You know, that's the kind of level. Now, until that is put in the public domain, until that is scrutinised, then surely, I mean, nobody would like to see us take this decision in a rush and hurry away with any kind of things of study documents again, I'm sure, but surely we need to put that in the public domain, and that would give us time for peer review of these kinds of statements, and we therefore need to find all the panelists to suggest that we need to follow this forward.
Does anybody else in the audience want to come in on the timing of the decision from the two previous speakers? Martin,
yes, my says it was expected to last for 30 or more years. I know that that's the position that Lord Green is still in the recent House of Lords debate, took up, and I know that that's what he was saying. Suddenly it changed for 25 years. But when the land study and various other studies were done, everybody said that the expected lease time was 14 years. Suddenly it's become 17 years. But when a defence answer was given by Adam Ingram just last year, he dated the timing of all the nuclear submarines, including the SSM, from when they were commissioned. And yet now, suddenly, it's become from when they were first tested by the company, because that's when the course started working. By an extraordinary coincidence, that evening, the decision was having to be taken just before the Prime Minister resigned from office, and at the time, it was very convenient for British Aerospace. Now, I may be terribly over-suspicious, but I'd be very interested in the comments of each decision.
Well, let me take comments from each to make. How comfortable are you with the pace in which this debate is being conducted, and do you feel that we need more time? And anyway, are we really taking a decision at the end of March when Parliament votes on whatever the motion might be, given that the way procurement's done, you don't ever really take a decision for some years afterwards in terms of commitment of money?
Well, I mean, there can be a doctrine of unripe time that sometimes people always say, need me to take a decision now, and that's quite often because they haven't made their own minds up and would rather not be required to come to a judgment. The question of timing, however, ultimately is a technical one. You know, I can't claim to have any personal qualifications to say it's 15 years, it's 17 years, it's 20 years. We can all, with respect to Michael, find some academic or some scientist who, in good faith, will give an alternative view. So I make two points as a result of that. First of all, it would be nice to be able to trust the government of your own country in the advice they give you on a matter of that kind. And one of the sadnesses of the terrible mistakes that were made over the Iraq War is that trust in government has been seriously eroded. So that when the Prime Minister or the government today say, we have to take a decision now, we don't automatically say, well, if that's what they're saying, we must assume that that's right. We were much more sceptical with understandable cause. The second point, and it goes back to the earlier question, is how do we take the debate forward? Well, I think what ought to happen, what I'm delighted if the Select Committee is going to go through this with a fine-tooth comb, and the government must cooperate with it. And most of the sessions, when the government gives evidence to a parliamentary committee, and let it be a joint committee of both houses, let it be in public. And if there are some matters that can't be held in public, then we have plenty of precedents for some sessions being taken in private, and with all the necessary precautions. So that way we would have a group of senior parliamentarians from both houses able to go step to step on the government's rationale and see if there are major flaws in the government's argument. If the government's comfortable with its position, it shouldn't be hostile to that. And if that takes a few months, what's a few months for a decision of this magnitude? Frank, how long do you want for the debate?
Well, I think we should get away with challenging whether the government's telling the truth or not, and just look at, supposing we did go ahead with the replacement of the boat, what is the build-up of costs over what years? And I think if you do it that way, in the earlier years, the costs are minimal. So Gateway 1, I would have thought, was rational for most of us to go through. There then does it clearly at some point, which will partly depend on the technical argument about the existing boats, you have to make a decision about major expenditure. My guess is that if we just look at the aircraft carrier orders, I used to represent a shipbuilding town, sadly we don't do any shipbuilding now, but I mean, I can't remember an order which was ever placed within the time frame that the government actually said because of other pressures. And my guess is that the financial pressures further down the line will allow the government to wonderfully say these boats have got an extra life compared with what they might now be saying. So I think we should go ahead with the initial expenditure, knowing that there will come a stage, some way down the line, when we have to make a decision about major expenditure, and that's clearly the much more important threshold to cross. But I agree totally with what's been said about the debate. The thing that struck me about this Parliament is, from the word go, it seemed like a fag-end Parliament. The whole atmosphere of the Parliament, as though we'd be ready to go into a general election, we're in our fourth year. I mean, business collapses because business managers haven't got anything to do. So to say that we haven't got time to actually use Parliament to start involving ourselves and then the wider audience is farcical beyond belief. And any decent wit would know it's far better to keep members occupied than not keep them occupied. So if one is worrying about the deterrent strategy in the whip's office, they would be in favour of the sort of debate that Malcolm's been speaking of. And that is the way to modernise Parliament, to say that our procedures need to change because this is such an important decision, we need to approach it in a different way. We don't want to do it in a theoretical approach, but in a very practical one.
Michael. What do you reckon the motion is going to be that you vote on eventually at the end of March?
I think the trouble at the moment is what's wrong with the debate is we ask the vote whether we're going to get the white paper. Can I just say on behalf of Professor Darwin, he'd be surprised at his track record than the American administration to describe as some academic. Yes. I think he probably knows more about it with this study than most people. When I was a minister, we used to get two types of submission, one of which ended up with recommendation, and there was a firm recommendation and the arguments led up to it, and that was it. And that meant your civil service had decided what they wanted you to do. The other sort was a lot came back with alternative recommendations at the end, which meant that they didn't want to take the middle themselves and they wanted you to take responsibility for it.
I'm telling you, I'm not like that now. There are no options.
I think the white paper is weak because it does give no options. I mentioned one possible alternative. I actually asked the MOD, where I understand the work that's being done about this, and I've asked them twice. Each time I got an answer saying you will receive an answer shortly. 6 months after I first started, I haven't had an answer yet. And it's clear to me the government does not want to discuss alternative options. And I think if we're going to have a proper debate, the structure should be that a senior committee, whether it's Privy Council, Delegation of Iceland, or another form of senior committee of both houses, examine specifically in private and confidential what the options are, and then present the options to the House of Commons so that these options can be properly debated. And if at the end of that there are no other options for effective deterrence, and Trident is the only one, well then I would have to revise my view. But at the moment, without the benefit of options and the suspicion that this is a government that is trying to steamroll this through, I think this is a very dangerous way to conduct the debate.
General for Mike Jackson.
Mike Jackson, representing Royal Navy these days. myself.
Yes.
I've been quite intrigued by where we've been over the last 40 minutes. Much of it has been about how, not whether. But I thought we were here to debate whether. And if you get the answer to whether right, so how much then follows that strategic decision, seems to me. Frankly, my eyes glaze over as to whether the votes will last until 2024 or 2027. It's of no consequence to the decision in principle to maintain or not a nuclear deterrent in this country. Because what we're talking about here is the future. The future out for several decades, 50 years plus. It's certainly in that sort of bracket. And I think what has become, if it hasn't been clear for some while, is that the one thing to expect is the unexpected. That you will not be able to forecast strategic circumstances half a century hence. And the uncertainty of events or potential opinions needs to be mirrored by the uncertainty of British reaction to new and varied threats. And we need to keep that uncertainty for ourselves. The point is being made about deliberation. It is inevitable. I can see no way of stopping it. The point was made, I think, a little earlier, would America or Israel allow Iran to become a nuclear power? Well, to prevent it, they probably have to use nuclear weapons. I would need convincing to not be that convention. It would be an enormous set stake. I don't know whether that's critical. That point may have been passed on to deliberation. Any threat, military, any threat, really has at least two components to it. One is capability. You can't threaten anybody with a big city if you don't own a big city. And the other is intent. If you have no intent to use a big city, then there's no threat. But the capability is technically very demanding. It needs a very complex industrial infrastructure. And it is something which has been built up over half a century and more. If it were to go, and we then decided, because we had got it wrong, that we needed to repossess nuclear weapons, I just wonder if this country would be able to do it. It probably could, but it would take a lot of time and a disproportionate effort at that time. We've heard a few red herrings, in my view. Cough. I've seen figures bandied around. My own feel for this is that acquisition of Blue Line costs are going to be, in today's money, somewhere around 2 to 2.5 billion. Maybe a bit less. Less.
No. Your time is less.
Okay.
Is this a glorious remark for a conclusion?
Is this for all of us?
Our government spending now running at $550 billion per annum. I think we need to keep such a proportion now. I've got to shut up, otherwise I'll be...
I do. Thank you, Mike. But you've raised an important question which didn't really come to the panel, which is the question of whether. Before I go back to the panel, I think it would be useful if we had, if you like, some of the counter-arguments, if they are there in the audience, to this question of whether. The fact that we come up to a decision point now, and should we be taking a decision to decide this is the moment at which we're no longer a nuclear power? Are there those who wish to make any points along those lines? Or is this a very... that's brave decision. Yes.
The
Ian
Davis from British American Security Information Council is really on the question of proliferation. The point is made that there's a rapid growth in number of nuclear powers over recent years. Well, when the NPT was first agreed, there was a suggestion that at that stage we could be facing 20 or 30 nuclear weapons states. That period in the late 1960s, early 1970s. Today we have no end to nuclear weapons states in the North Korea. I think the non-proliferation regime is more about the nuclear credit war. and it's not going to actually roll back the domestic programme in countries without the use of those reforms to negotiate with the carriers. And that's happened in a number of states. It appears to be one of the first steps towards that progress working in North Korea. So I think it's dangerous to say that one of the already states is exposed to the weapons. There is an increasing use of capability in states that are not only technology to use the power of that nuclear weapon, but and we also need to therefore look at the impact of British decision on proliferation activities. The large review conference of the NPT in New York was a complete failure, and there's a real sense amongst the non-nuclear weapons states. There are 184 nations around the world, many in Europe, that are still going to get by with their own nuclear deterrent. Many of these are getting exacerbated by the stance of the nuclear weapons states like Britain. And these are people who are being made not just by NGOs like my own, but people like Michael today. Kissinger and the senior leader in the United States, Dr. John Baradai, head of the IAEA. So I think the impact on this decision on the, the global proliferation needs to be seriously considered. That's one of the key reasons why we need to delay this decision at the moment.
Do I have any others who want to enter this debate? Sorry, what surprise case? Case
that's from the CND. Rather noticeable that the panelists didn't very much talk about the legal aspects and the nuclear non-proliferation treaty framework. Ian was talking about the non-proliferation elements there. But what about the requirements towards disarmament, which is obviously sort of the twin build of the NPT? I wonder if the panelists could refer to that.
Okay, I'll come back to the panel now if I may, because Mike has set us an important question here as to the decision about whether, and the question that proliferation actually hasn't been as bad as sometimes people talk about. The NPT has had an effect, but it's not doing very well now. What can we do to re-energise arms control, take into account worries about the legal aspects, and do we think that the government's proposal in the white paper of a 20% reduction in warheads is a good thing that's going to get arms control going again? Frank.
I want to turn it back to Mike, actually, in that for me, and my own position may be totally eccentric compared with everybody else's, what I've got to settle in my mind is whether, in fact, if we went down this road, we would actually have an independent here, i.e. that we could use it against America's wishes.
I subscribe to Mark's wishes.
You think that?
I do. When it comes to it, it is a matter between the Prime Minister and the Captain of that boat.
Can I just throw in an extra dimension to the question here, which some of the other panelists want to pick up? While I subscribe to to Malcolm's view on the operational decision making, there is the question that the missiles themselves are serviced in an American pool, which if cooperation is withdrawn over a period of time, we would lose the capability there. Is this a worry or not? But I just add that extra.
You could, if you're required to, develop our own capacity to do that. It would take time, it would cost money, but it could be done.
Okay. Right. Do you want to pick up? I mean, I'm sure you agree with everything Mike said. It sounded very similar things, but do you want to pick up the arms control?
Yeah, absolutely. I can deal with Cape Hudson's point. Three short points I'd like to make. Yes, the treaty does impose a general obligation on all countries to move towards general disarmament, and the question of nuclear weapons states is within that general context. Now, sadly, over the last 30, 40 years, there has been no will anywhere in the world to actually translate that into a real movement towards general disarmament. And the vast proportion of the resources spent on armaments are not nuclear, they're conventional weapons of one kind or another. I think that successive British governments, Conservative and Labour, can claim the credit that we have unilaterally decided to so reduce our own nuclear capability in the way that I described earlier, that you could hardly reduce Britain's nuclear capability further without it ceasing to be a nuclear power. So we have made a very substantial move, and I don't think that has been seriously challenged. And Kissinger has been mentioned once or twice. Kissinger is not calling for general disarmament. The actual recommendations of Kissinger and his colleagues are very sensible recommendations in favour of reducing the likelihood of weapons being used by accident or by mistake, to have hotlines and things of that kind which are highly desirable. The final point I would make is we have to ask ourselves, we're not contemplating acquiring them for the first time. It's quite a different matter when you've had something which you've had since the 1950s and you're contemplating giving it up. And the question has to be, what would we achieve? Yes, we would have some more resources available for conventional defence, but whether the Treasury would allow that to happen is another matter. They might pocket the savings and it would never be seen by the armed forces. But that aside, there would be no benefit. And the idea that the North Koreans or the Iranians or other rogue states would allow their judgments as to whether they're going to try and develop nuclear weapons to be materially influenced by whether the United Kingdom discontinues it. I mean, that is, you know, just so improbable as to not require, I think, further consideration. So I come back to the point I mentioned earlier. Nuclear weapons, Britain has shown itself irresponsible power. No one in their remote mind expects the United Kingdom to use them in an aggressive way. They are an ultimate insurance for this country in a very stable, unstable world, which despite the end of the Cold War, is still a nuclear world and where the number of nuclear fires has grown, not diminished, in the last 25 years. Insurance is something which is very sensible, both in our own private lives and in the national life of this country.
I could have got the last word.
I think that Mike is right to say that the question is weather, but I think there isn't just one weather, there's three weather. The first is weather deterrence. Now, I have no difficulty in saying yes, we need a deterrent. And I don't know yet whether all countries will build it or not, we can't actually answer that question. The second is whether nuclear, and that again depends on other possibilities there are. And again, we haven't got any sufficient information about to answer that question. The third is whether Trident, which is where we started from. Now the whole point about Trident is it is regarded as being the ideal vehicle because it's invisible under the water, apart from the fact that three out of the four are above water at any given time, there's one under, is one point. But secondly, we're talking about 20 years' time. We've got to know if we're going to spend a lot of money on building the next generation of boats, that these will continue to be invisible. The technology is not going to make it possible to actually identify and locate these ships or boats from space. I haven't got enough information on that. We're not being given this information. I don't think we should take a decision until all those unknowns are known.
Thank you for that. And can I thank our three speakers? I steered carefully away from making any political points. The only thing I should have asked was, because I'm feeling slightly sensitive about it, is how the other two parties are going to test the opinion of their members. We have a debate on Saturday morning, which you should be able to read in your Sunday papers, as to what the membership of the Lib Dems decide the policy is from then onwards. It's going to be an exciting Saturday, I have to say.
What is the leadership going to do if its policy is rejected?
There is no possibility of that.
Thank you. So much.
But can I thank Jonathan of the Global Security, Global Strategy Forum, if I can get it right, for giving us an opportunity to continue this debate. The one consensus view I think we had around the table and within the audience was that there is a need for a debate. Thank you very much indeed.